नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। Since today is the anniversary of Lumbucha's passing away, I thought I would read a few more of his teachings. I've been reading a few things through today already. Firstly, I thought I would read a little bit more of one of the passages that I read at the morning reflection time earlier in the temple. So this is from the talk, Still Flowing Water. Some people complain, I can't meditate, I'm too restless. Whenever I sit down, I think of this and that. I can't do it. I've got too much bad karma. I should use up my bad karma first and then come back and try meditating. Sure, try it. Try using up your bad karma. That's a sarcastic statement. It means don't do that. This is how people think. Why do they think like this? These so-called hindrances are the things we must study. Whenever we sit, the mind immediately goes running off. We follow it and try to bring it back and observe it once more. Then it goes off again. This is what you're supposed to be studying. Most people refuse to learn their lessons from nature, like a naughty schoolboy who refuses to do his homework. They don't want to see the mind changing. How then are you going to develop wisdom? We have to live with change like this. When we know that the mind is just this way, constantly changing, when we know that this is its nature, we will understand it. We have to know when the mind is thinking good and bad, changing all the time. We have to know these things. If we understand this point, then even while we are thinking, we can be at peace. For example, suppose at home you have a pet monkey. Monkeys don't stay still for very long. They like to jump around and grab onto things. That's how monkeys are. Now you come to the monastery and see the monkey here. This monkey doesn't stay still either. It jumps around just the same. But it doesn't bother you, does it? Why doesn't it bother you? Because you've raised a monkey before. You know what they're like. If you know just one monkey, no matter how many provinces you go to, no matter how many monkeys you see, you won't be bothered by them, will you? This is one who understands monkeys. If we understand monkeys, then we won't become a monkey. If you don't understand monkeys, then you may become a monkey yourself. Do you understand? When you see it reaching for this and that, you shout, "Hey!" You get angry. That damned monkey? This is one who doesn't know about monkeys. One who knows monkeys sees that the monkey at home and the monkey in the monastery are just the same. Why should you get annoyed by them? When you see what monkeys are like, that's enough. You can be at peace. Peace is like this. We must know sensations. Some sensations are pleasant, some are unpleasant, but that's not important. That's just their business. Just like the monkey, all monkeys are the same. We understand sensations are sometimes agreeable, sometimes not. That's just their nature. We should understand them and know how to let them go. Sensations are uncertain, they're transient, imperfect, and ownerless. Everything that we perceive is like this. When eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind receive sensations, we know them, just like knowing the monkey. Then we can be at peace. So this was a regular theme of Lumpur's teaching, since so many people would relate to meditation as a way of sort of switching off or disconnecting from things, and would say be upset by the noise they would hear from the village, often in Thailand, even in these days, back in the 70s and 80s, you get In the villages, they would often have most of their entertainment in the evening, and so you have these PA systems blasting out through the countryside. Any of you who have been to forest monasteries nowadays will be familiar with that kind of presence in the air, and so that that sense of I can't meditate because there's these annoying things, or often people who were villagers or townspeople would say, oh, I've got so many responsibilities with my work. I'm a school teacher. I've got 5 kids. I've got the farm to look after. And so over and over again, rather than those things being that which is in the way of the practice, Lumpur Cha would say, well, this is actually what you practice with. These are the quote-unquote monkeys. That if you understand that rather than that those being an obstacle to peace, they're what you learn from, and then understanding that the mind's nature is to run after sensations, like and dislike, approving, disapproving, and so forth, then, as he says, once you know that monkeys are like that, once you know that that's the way that the mind works, and the peace is in the attitude, not in the object. A lot of noise or a lot of activity, you realize there can be plenty of people around, there can be responsibilities of your family or your work situation, or a lot of noise in the monastery, the forest night, or the PA from the village playing a movie. You can still be at peace because the peace is in the attitude, not in the object. Does that make sense? Any questions, thoughts on that? Very quiet group this year at Amaravati. Other years we had much more.
It's interesting, I think. Yes. Earlier in the passage he talks about controlling the mind. Mm-hmm. Then he seems to infer that we need to simply observe them.
Well, they work together because if you have if you want to just observe the mind, then you have to deal with the reactivity of the habit of following what we like or opposing what we dislike. And so that the quality of composure or calming the mind, it helps to that quality of reactivity to be known, and to also to go against those habits of I like something, therefore I've got to take hold of it, or I dislike something, therefore hating it or fearing it, resenting it is automatic. So that sense of control is also, guiding the mind towards calm, is of, in a sense, making it easier to work with. So making creating the conditions whereby you can watch the habits of mind more easily, like having one monkey in the house rather than 18 monkeys in the house. Make it a little bit easier to to watch what's going on and not to get too drawn in and upset. That makes sense? Yeah, and then to be recognizing that if there's a problem, or if there's a sense of wrongness, then it's only coming from the attitude. It's not coming from the impact of what you're hearing or seeing or smelling or tasting or touching. That the over and over again, he would emphasize that the peace lies in the attitude. Obviously, the reason why we keep the precepts, or that we try to be skillful in the way that we relate to other people in a way that's respectful and kind and compassionate and so forth, those are creating as many positive conditions as possible, so that you're, again, that's a creating the causes for calmness and clarity. That's why, in a way, that's one of the reasons why goodness is good. It creates the ground for peacefulness. If you break a lot of precepts, if you go around thumping people, or that you start yelling at people in the temple, and then people get upset, say, well, get over it, just you're attached to your senses, then you're creating a lot of confusion and difficulty, so it makes it much, those objects are much harder to work with. So that keeping the precepts, living in a skillful way, cultivating wholesome, noble qualities, then they're, in a sense, clearing the space as much as possible, and making it as the heart as sort of clear and open a space as can be done, in order observers, rather than having a room full of clutter, like your living room full of extra furniture or kind of piles of clothes, you know, dirty clothes and books and magazines all over the floor, and a whole lot of you know, you at least tidy up the living room and you put things away and clean the carpet and tidy the cushions, and then you have a clearer and tidier space to work with. Then you can it creates an environment of clarity and sort of calmness and peacefulness, which makes it easier to observe what's going on. If things are sort of cluttered and confused, then naturally it's harder to observe exactly what's happening. Well, going beyond that, I mean, the wisdom faculty recognizes that, you know, this is conventionally good and conventionally harmful, but it's also recognizing that anything that's attached to, if that's taken as an absolute value, then that's going to, any kind of grasping or any for claiming around any aspect of experience is going to cause a sense of alienation and dukkha. So that, as you said, going beyond good and evil, it doesn't mean not following the precepts. You know? It means that seeing that the good and bad are relative values, that they are they're conditioned qualities based on the human perspective, if you like, but that in and of itself there's just these patterns of nature arising, passing away, and so that is one of the hallmarks of the Buddha's teaching, is that you have this sort of transcendent viewpoint, but its partner is the cultivation of wholesome qualities and the letting go of unwholesome qualities on the conditioned plane, and those two work together. That conduct and wisdom, vijja and charana, they work together as a partnership. So vijja charana sampanno, so perfect in knowledge and conduct. So that some spiritual teachings will just emphasize the transcendent view and say, well, conduct doesn't really matter, or it's insignificant, it's just the conditioned world, don't worry about that. But along with Lumpo Cha, say, talking in that way, you know, letting go of good and evil, he was also extremely demanding as a teacher, and incredibly scrupulous. And, like the other day I was pointing out, even though he can make a point of saying something like I read this morning, that to speak of birth and death is to use the language of ignorant children. Still, he was extremely scrupulous, and you know, he wouldn't deliberately kill a mosquito. He couldn't kill a mosquito, or if there was termites in his kuti, he would brush them out of the way with incredible care. So on the wisdom side, birth and death is it, to speak of birth and death is the language of ignorant children, but there are these termites that might be harmed if they're not moved out of the way. So let's invite the termites to move as gently as possible. Yeah, it's not uncommon in the Thai forest tradition. So the Thai for it is jit dham. Dham means original or primary. So it was a phrase that Ajahn Mun used, and essentially speaking about the unconditioned, that dimension of mind, which is unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, and so forth. And so it sounds more like Zen or Tibetan, but it's actually they come from the same sources as it was in the Thai forest tradition. Like say in the those teachings from the Udana, like we chant quite regularly, there is the unborn, the unconditioned, the unformed, the unoriginated, the unformed, the unconditioned. And if there was not the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the unformed, then liberation from the born, created, the formed would not be possible. So that term, say, original mind, is I'm not sure where Ajahn Mun would have heard that from. Maybe from his teacher Ajahn Sao, but that's a very ordinary, a customary way of speaking about that quality in the forest tradition. Well, that area of teachings, or sometimes the word Satchatamma, like the true Dhamma, or Paramatta Satcha, the ultimate reality, which you get from time to time in the Pali canon, then it's referring to the same qualities. That's also from that. That's in the same section of the Udana, chapter 8 of the Udana. Yes, yeah, it's so that there in that you have those two suttas in the chapter 8 of the Udana, and one says, you know, there is that ayatana. That uses the Pali word ayatana, which means like a sphere of being, or that dimension. Where there is no sun, no moon, no stars, no coming into being, no dying, no disappearance, no coming, no going, no standing still, and then the Buddha says this is the end of suffering. So that, and there's two suttas. One is sutta number one, the other is sutta number three, the one about the unborn, unoriginated, uncreated. So they're close to each other in that chapter 8 of the Udana. That's a different sutta.
Yeah, but I'm interested in
this. Well, there's that phrase, vinyanang anidasanang anantang sabato pabang. You were mentioning it in the Dhamma talk the other night?
Yeah.
Vinyanang anidasanang anantang sabato pabang. It's relating to the same quality. So that is very often quoted by Lumpo Sumato. So that phrase appears in two different suttas. One is the Kevada Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, and the other one is called the Invitation to a Brahma. So they're both used when the Buddha is speaking, when it's about a conversation with the Brahma god. So Ajahn Pasno's pet theory is that particular phrase relates to some kind of Vedic teaching that was around at the Buddha's time, because it's the only time it appears in the Pali canon is when the Buddha, when there's a dialogue with a Brahma god. So it's Ajahn Pasno's idea as well. Probably it was a sort of a riff on a theme from a familiar teaching relating to Brahmins, or a Vedic teaching that's been lost. But the Buddha, what appears in the Pali canon is sort of the Buddha's take upon that. Because you find a similar thing in quite a number of other places where the Buddha takes a particular theme and works on it for a different purpose. Like in a similar area, the teaching to Bahia, in the seen there is only the seen, in the heard there is only the heard. So Bahia was a bark clad ascetic. He was he wore robes made out of tree bark. And there is a connection between the way the Buddha speaks to Bahia and what's called the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, one of the Upanishads, which was particularly connected with the bark-wearing ascetics. And so that there's a connection there that you can find academic papers about it. Can't quote exactly where, but I have been shown those. So that then the Buddha, okay, he's a bark-wearing ascetic. This is a teaching he's familiar with, and then the Buddha would make his own take upon it. to explain to this fellow, okay, this is his background. Okay, I'll talk about it in this way. And so, like, he would, if he was meeting a cow herd, he would talk about cows. Or he was talking to a soldier, he'd talk about, you know, the military campaign or something. So that phrase, the Vijñānaṃ Anidassanaṃ and Anantaṃ Sabbatopabhaṃ, it appears in these two different places, whereas they're talking about a dialogue with a Brahma god. And then it's the only places where the word vijnana is used to describe a liberated quality of awareness. Usually vijnana literally means a discriminative consciousness or a distinction between one thing and another. But in those two instances, it's referring to the enlightened mind very, very clearly from the context of what's said. So as Lumpo Samedo is very fond of quoting that, and when he uses the word consciousness, it's usually with that kind of transcendent awareness in mind. So that when you have the word consciousness with Lumpo Samedo's voice, then it's the Anidassana Vijnana. So then the phrase means Anidassana means, so Vijnanaṃ means the consciousness or the awareness. Anidassana, which means is non-manifest, it has no appearance or no form, it's invisible or unimaginable, intangible. Ananta means limitless, infinite. And then Sabbato Pabhaṃ, it can either mean radiant in all directions or accessible from every side. There's scholarly debates upon exactly, but it can mean either of those things, so that the consciousness which is unmanifest or invisible, in the writings of Bhikkhu Nyanananda, then he comes up with this wonderful word, non-manifestative, which is very unusual English. Non-manifestative, so it's something that it doesn't stand out, it doesn't have a form, it doesn't manifest, and that's described as it's in that quality of awareness or consciousness. Then there's no long, no short, the long and short and coarse and fine and pure and impure can find no footing. They can't get any grip. They can't get any traction. And so it's describing that quality of awareness where, like, long and short, coarse and fine, pure and impure, inside and outside, all those dualities, they can't get any traction. They can't find a footing is the usual terminology. Or there's no landing place for those dualities in that awareness. So it's a kind of expression of that within the Theravada canon of non-dualistic, say, appreciation of experience. Well, he's said an awful, pretty almost every Dhamma talk since 1991 has been on that theme. I don't have any memory of him saying like a particular talk that he heard or no particular individual event. I think just through his own reflection, and that's what, I mean, he speaks very much from his own experience. And so then It's like, well, that's what's here. That's what this reality is. And so that he speaks from that. So this next Dhamma talk is from the collection called Everything is Teaching Us. This is called Knowing the World. All things, just as they are, display the truth. But we have biases and preferences about how we want them to be. Lokavidu means knowing the world clearly. The world is these phenomena, sabhava, abiding as they are. To put it simply, the world is arom. So that's a Thai word, arom, which comes from the Pali word aramana. It means a mood or a sense impression, an attitude. I think there's a few Thai people here. So arom's got quite a range of meanings, but it's the Lumpur is saying here, you know, the world is arom. The world is our set of attitudes and impressions of that arise based on the senses and on the emotional tone of the mind. So even though it comes from the Pali word aramana, which is a bit more of a narrow meaning like a mental object, then arom has a broader range of meanings in Thai. To sum it up simply, the world is arom. That's an easy way to put it. The world is arom. If we say the world, that's pretty vast. Arom, are the world, is a lot simpler. Our moods are the world. The world is arom. Being deluded by the world is being deluded by arom, by our moods. Being deluded by arom is being deluded by the world. Lokavidu means knowing the world clearly. However the world is, that's what we should know. It exists according to its conditions. So we should have full present awareness of it. Sankara for what they are. Develop wisdom that knows sankara, the world of things. Whatever the truth of sankara is, however they really are, that's the truth we should know. That's called wisdom that accepts and knows without obstacles. We need to develop a mind that has tranquility together with wisdom in control of things. We talk about sila, samadhi, and panya, and about samatha meditation and vipassana meditation, but they are really all the same matter. They are the same, but we divide them into different categories and get confused. I've often made a simple analogy about it. There are things to compare it to, which can make it easier to contemplate and understand. A little mango later becomes a large, ripe mango. Is the little mango the same piece of fruit as the large one? From the time it's just a bud flowering on the tree, it's the same one mango. As it grows into a small mango and then gets bigger and bigger, almost ripe, then finally ripe, it's only undergoing change. The aspects of practice we talk about are the same. Sila simply means giving up wrongdoing. A person without sila is in a hot condition. Giving up wrongdoing and evil ways brings coolness, preventing harm or ill effects. The blessing that comes from this freedom from harmful effects is a tranquil mind. That is samadhi. When the mind is in samadhi, clean and pure, it'll see many things. It's like water that is still and undisturbed. You can see your face in it. You can see things further away reflected as well. You can see the roof of the building over there. If a bird alights on the roof, you can see it. These factors are really all one, just like the one mango. The tiny fruit is the same one mango. The growing fruit is the same mango. The ripe fruit is the same mango. From green to yellow, it's the same mango. It's undergoing change, and that's why we see difference. Having this kind of simple understanding can put us all at ease. Doubts will diminish. If instead we're relying on texts and seeking detailed explanations, we're likely to end up in confusion. So we have to watch our own minds. Bhikkhus, you should be watching over your minds. Those who watch over their minds shall escape the snares of Mara, was said by the Buddha. Both Mara and his snares, and it depends on our own investigation. My way of practice was a little strange. After I ordained and started to practice, I had a lot of doubts and questions, but I didn't like to ask anyone about them very much. Even when I met Ajahn Mun, I didn't ask him many questions. I wanted to ask, but I didn't. I sat and listened to his teaching. I had questions, but I didn't ask. Asking someone else is like borrowing someone else's knife to cut something. We never come to have our own knife. That's the way I felt, so I didn't ask many questions of others. If I stayed with the teacher for a year or two, I'd listen to his discourses and try to work things out for myself. I would seek my own answers. I was different from other disciples, but I was able to develop wisdom. This way made me resourceful and clever. I didn't become heedless. Rather, I contemplated things until I could see for myself, increasing my understanding and removing my doubts. My advice is to not let yourself get wrapped up in doubts and questions. Let them go and directly contemplate whatever you are experiencing. Don't make a big deal out of any physical pleasure or pain that you experience. When you sit in meditation and start to feel tired or uncomfortable, adjust your position. Endure as much as you can, and then move. Don't overdo it. Develop a lot of mindfulness. That's the point. Do your walking and sitting meditation as much as you can. The aim is to be developing mindfulness as much as you can, knowing things fully. That's enough. Please take my words to contemplate. Whatever form of practice you're doing, when objects of mind arise, whether internally or externally, those are called arom. The one who is aware of the arom is called, well, whatever you want to call it, is okay. You can call it mind. The arom is one thing, and the one who knows the arom is another. It's like the eye and the objects it sees. The eye isn't the objects, and the objects aren't the eye. The ear hears sounds, but the ear isn't the sound, and the sound isn't the ear. When there is contact between the two, then things happen. All states of mind, happy or unhappy, are called arom. Whatever they may be, never mind. We shouldn't constantly be reminding ourselves, whatever they may be, never mind. We should constantly be reminding ourselves that this is uncertain, quote unquote. People don't consider very much that this is uncertain. Just this is the vital factor that will bring about wisdom. It's really important. In order to cease our coming and going and come to rest, we only need to say, this is uncertain. Sometimes we may be distraught over something to the point that tears are flowing. This is something not certain. When moods of desire or aversion come to us, we should just remind ourselves of this one thing. Whether standing, walking, sitting, or lying down, whatever appears is uncertain. Can't you do this? Keep it up no matter what happens. Give it a try. You don't need a lot. Just this will work. This is something that brings wisdom. The way I practice meditation is not very complicated. Just this. This is what it all comes down to. It's uncertain. Mein Herr. Everything meets at this point. Don't keep track of the various instances of mental experience. When you sit, there may be various conditions of mind appearing, seeing and knowing all manner of things, experiencing different states. Don't be keeping track of them. Literally, don't count them. Don't get wrapped up in them. You only need to remind yourself that they're uncertain. That's enough. That's easy to do. It's simple. Then you can stop. Knowledge will come, but then don't make too much out of that or get attached to it. So this is a very common theme of his, that people would often come and say, oh, I've had this experience in meditation, this kind of blissful feeling, or these strange sensations of around my head, or this weird energies moving through the body, and or this the visions that would arise of seeing my parents, or seeing a landscape that I've never visited before. And what does this mean, Lumpur? So over and over again, people would come with these kind of questions. They still do, to any of us who are teaching meditation. And this will be his principal response, will be, don't make much of them. The main issue is, are they changing? Did it arise? Did it pass away? Okay, that's all you need to know. And so sometimes people will be quite deflated. They say, yeah, but the Buddha came and talked to me. He gave me a whole Dhammadesana. He says, well, did it begin and end? Well, yeah, of course, but there you go, it's anicca. But it was the Buddha, he came and talked to me. And so, but that would be basically, don't make too much of it. Don't complicate things. Don't create stories around them. And that those can be experiences that are very sort of inspiring and wonderful and beautiful, or they can be something that's sort of terrible or strange or really unsettling or just plain weird. Like I used to get this feeling after I sat for a long time. If I had a long meditation for like an hour and a half, a couple of hours, I feel my hands were upside down, and they weren't, but they would feel like they were turned upside down, and I have this distinct sensation. How did my hands get turned upside down? But they're not. And I'd kind of sneak a look with my eyes, like, no, they're the right way up. But the feeling, I close my eyes and they'd feel like they were upside down again. But what the heck is that about? Why are my hands upside down? Go figure, as they say in the States. But hey, Lumpu Cha's advice would be, don't read too much into it. Don't make things out of it, because often, it's particularly if you have a very sort of powerful or very blissful or insightful experience in meditation, that even though the content of the experience can be quite wholesome and beautiful and wise, the way the mind grabs hold of it and the story it makes around it can create all kinds of complications. So the emphasis he would give is like, well, look at the attitude that there is towards that, rather than how powerful it was, or how meaningful it was, or the details of the content. It's very easy to have some extremely wholesome, beautiful meditation experience, and then make it into a complete nightmare for all the people that you live with, because you suddenly be convinced, okay, I'm really special. I've attained some kind of great achievement, and then you carry that around like you're some kind of special being, and it can be a real burden for yourself and others, and just the sense of self gathers around that. Okay. I think I was mentioning the other day about someone who had misheard a comment that Lumpur Sumato made about when he had this very powerful, beautiful experience in meditation, and Lumpur Sumato had said, "Oh, that's called sobhana citta, which means beautiful mind." And he thought Lumpur had said that you're a sotapanna, you're a stream enterer. He literally misheard what Lumpur had said. And so then now, a little while later, he said to, when we were, this is in the early days of Chittos, he said, "Oh, well, Ajahn Sumedho told me I'm a sotapanna." Really? I don't think so. He never says that kind of thing to anybody. It's just not his way of thinking. And he said, "No, he told me I'm a stream enterer." He said, "Oh, I'm a sotapanna." And I was telling the story the other day how I waited for the right moment some time later, and sort of checked up on it with Lumpur Sumato. I said, "So-and-so said that you said that he was a sotapanna, but I think he must have misunderstood that." He said, and then Lumpur said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, he said you told him that he's a sotapanna. How did he get that idea?" And I said, "Well, you were talking about sobhanajitta." And he said, "Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a beautiful mind state. I had it when I was a novice in Nongkhar. Yeah, everything looks beautiful and radiant and glorious." And he said, "And I think what happened was that you mentioned that this fellow described this meditation experience that he had, and you said it was sobhanajitta." He said, "Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's what I said to him." He said, "Ah, he heard sotapanna." Oh, so he was carrying around the idea. "I just somebody was told me I'm a stream enterer." And that he literally heard things incorrectly, and that and was sort of wearing it like a sort of badge. "Oh, I think somebody told me on the street." And so I don't know if how we broke it to him. It's long ago. It's nearly 40 years ago now, but I forget. I think there's some way or other it was suggested to him that he might possibly have misheard that. But normally, Ajahn Sumedho doesn't talk that way to people who make those kind of claims. Yes.
Question about so regarding reviewing or evaluating one's meditation experiences, calling it good experience, bad experience, all that, some advice is given by some teachers more outside of this tradition is to, after having meditated, check, okay, what were the conditions? Is it something, do you think there's any value in trying to understand, not so much that it's not so much the approach.
Well, you could probably see my expression on my face going, bad idea.
So just go.
Yeah, because I frequently say how just naming a meditation as good or bad is problematic, because you know, you can have something that's a very beautiful, wholesome mind state and turn it into a monster. You get attached to that, and then even though it was a wholesome state, the obsession with getting back to recreating that or feeling that you've attained something because of that says, "Oh, you know, this is a good thing in and of itself." And so the attention goes away from how the mind is relating to it. Similarly, you can have a really quote unquote disastrous meditation. Your mind is going racing around all over the place. It's just filled with greed, hatred, and delusion, and total confusion. But even though the content of what's being experienced is not a good meditation, there can be the very skillful attitude towards it. But wow, you know, the mind is a total mess today. Look at that. I wonder where that came from. Yeah, sometimes it's like that. So even though the content is really sort of unskillful and chaotic, it can actually bring great insight and be a source of wisdom. So that labeling things as good meditation, bad meditation, I would say hold that with caution. And obviously, there are things that are wholesome and things that are unwholesome. You can see that those qualities are there. Like if you're on the washing up, you know, when a pot is clean and a pot it needs to be cleaned. Like, no, this is a pot that hasn't been cleaned yet. It's got vegetables baked on the side, and it's not clean. And then this is the you know, where the pots have been scrubbed and they're kind of shiny and bright. Yeah, they are clean. So there's a discrimination. You can recognize that. But then it's the way that the mind relates to wholesome and unwholesome, and picks those up or creates an identity around those. That's in a way almost more important than the content of a particular meditation experience. So sometimes, for many people, dealing with a pain in their knees or a pain in their back or a headache that's been there for a day and a half can bring far more wisdom and wholesome qualities. You can be the source of much more the development of much more paramita than having the mind just be quiet and concentrated and focused on the breath. Even though you wouldn't choose to have a painful knee or a 3-day headache, that can be something that is more productive of wisdom. So that's very much a style of approach of Lumpo Cha's to, you recognize the wholesome and things that are beautiful, and you work in the meditation to, say, cultivate wholesome states and clarity and concentration and so on. But it's the whole book is called Everything is Teaching Us. it's called that for a reason. So that you, if you are wise, then the sort of confused mess states and the clear and bright states and everything in between will all be teachers for us.
Arjun, do you think that sometimes it seems that people have a problem because they're thinking that if they have a good state or maybe start to get a good state, so something might happen in the future, you know, that you have a lot of future. I think they can only be here and now. I think what Arjun Chah wants to do is this present moment, and that's a word I can only use the word not now, but this is as it. Anything else you want on top of that changes it. It can't be any different than this. You don't have to like it, dislike it. So meditation is not a thing that you're trying to achieve or do or get rid of anything, because the whole point of meditation is this. Anything you put on top of that takes you away from this, doesn't it?
Well, it depends on the attitude. I mean, there's reasons why we sit still with our eyes closed for hours on end in the temple or walk up and down. Those methods of training have a purpose. They're not completely just random behaviors. It's all in the attitude. It's like over and over again, Lumpo Samhita would say, if you're doing something now in order to become enlightened in the future, then you're missing the point. The point is to be awake now. But the formal practices, so keeping the precepts, training the mind to concentrate, the development of the baramis, that they're all to do with helping the mind to genuinely be awake to the present reality, and to not get caught up in doing something now to get something in the future. So they work together, and it's not the Buddha's teach. The Buddha said that his teaching is a path of effort. It's a path of doing. It's a path of action, making choices. It's not a passivity. So that there is work that's being done, but if that work that's being done is based on mindfulness and wisdom rather than being guided by self-view and I've got to get this and I've got to get rid of that, I should be this way, I shouldn't be that way, then that effort, that direction that is given to the practice, it is one that conduces to that quality of awakeness. And so that it's sometimes the way that the teachings can give an impression that, oh, any kind of doing, any kind of choice making is an intrusion upon reality. Any kind of action or effort is somehow a disturbance of the Dhamma. But your choice, your ability to choose is part of the way things are. So choosing wholesomeness over unwholesomeness, if that's based upon mindfulness and wisdom rather than I should be this way, I shouldn't be that way. If it's based on mindfulness and wisdom, and that's the guiding force rather than self-view, then that that effort it leads to peacefulness. It's peaceful in its presence, and it leads to greater peacefulness. So that's what the term practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma it refers to. So that there's a doing, there's a directing of the mind, and a decision making. For this life, that is entirely in tune with Dhamma. So even though direction is being given and choices are being made, that's not a disturbance of reality, it's an expression of reality. Yes, yeah. So that it's the attitude is the, everything hinges around attitude, and then the way that if the practice can be freed from self-view, then the efforts that are made are joyful. They're not like, I wish I didn't have to bother with doing this. Oh, I'm looking forward to the weekend. I can't wait till the retreat's over, or till the retreat begins, or I can't wait till I'm retired, or I don't have to bother. You know, that it's all of that waiting for this to be over is based on self-view. If there's a letting go of self-view and conceit, then the mind is not creating self and time in the same way. And so that there's the guiding of this life and its habits of thinking and speech and action towards what is wholesome, what is noble, what's beautiful, is done not because I should be this way, I shouldn't be that way, I've got to get more of this, I've got to get rid of that, but rather this is a skillful direction to go. This leads towards peacefulness. Let this track be followed. Okay, read a little bit more. Real investigation in the correct way, doesn't involve thinking. As soon as something contacts the eye, ear, nose, tongue, or body, it immediately takes place of its own. You don't have to pick anything up to look at. Things just present themselves, and investigation happens of its own. We talk about vitaka, initial thought. It means raising something up. Vichara is discursive thought. It's investigation, seeing the planes of existence that appear. In the final analysis, the way of the Buddha flourishes through impermanence. It's always timely and relevant, whether in the time of the Buddha, in other times past, in the present age, or in the future. At all times, it is impermanence that rules. This is something that you should meditate on. So then, I'll read a last little bit from this. This is a dialogue that took place when Lumpur Cha came back to the West for the second time. And this, I think this is when he's arrived in England in 1979. And I think it was around the time that Chidhurst was beginning. So it's sort of there. I think they're staying in London. I'm not sure whether this took place at the Hampstead Vihara or in the in Chidhurst as they were moving into it. But it was around about that time. It was the summer of 1979. So Lumpur has sort of come back. Ajahn Sumedho and the group has been based in England for a couple of years. Ajahn Sundra was still hovering around the edges. Hadn't quite moved in then, right? Summer of 79? Ah. I think Ajahn Chandasiri was around. And Tanisra and Rojana, they were around. Ajahn Sundra was... her karma hadn't ripened at that point. Okay. So it's around that time, so that sort of when Chidhurst was opening and just sort of running up to the beginning of the rains retreat. Anyway. Just to read a little bit of this. So it starts off with Lumpur teaching. There's a dialogue between him and Ajahn Sumedho. Whatever you will teach, it won't be outside of Sila, Samadhi, and Panya, or to use another standard of classification, morality, meditation, and generosity. People here are already pretty complicated. People here are already pretty complicated. You have to look at those you are teaching and understand them. Because they are complicated, you have to give them something they can relate to. Just to say, let go, won't be right. Put that aside for the time being. It's like talking to older people in Thailand. If you try to speak bluntly, they will resent it. If I do that, it's okay. They'll hear it from me. It pleases them. But otherwise, they would get angry. You can be able to speak well, but still not be skillful. Right, Sumedho? It's like that, isn't it? Lumpur Sumedho says, it is. They, some of the other monks, speak the truth, but they don't do it skillfully, and the lay people don't want to listen. They don't have the skillful means. Lumpur Cha responds, right. They don't have a technique. They don't have the technique in speaking. Like construction. I can build things, but I don't have a technique for construction. To make things beautiful and long-lasting. I can speak. Anyone can speak. But it's necessary to have a skillful means to know what is appropriate. Then, saying even one word can be of benefit. Otherwise, you can cause trouble with your words. For example, people here have learned a lot of things. Don't go extolling your way. My way is right, your way is wrong. Don't do that. Don't merely try to be profound either. You can lead people to madness by that. Just say, don't discard other ways you may have learned, but for the time being, please put them aside and focus upon what we're practicing right now. For example, mindfulness of breathing. That's something that you can all teach. Teach to focus on the breath going in and out. Just keep teaching in the same way and let people get an understanding of this. When you become skilled at teaching one thing, your ability to teach will develop on its own, and you'll be able to teach other things. Coming to know one thing well, people can then know many things. It happens of its own. But if you try to teach them many things, they don't get a real understanding of any one thing. If you point out one thing clearly, then they can know many things clearly. Like those Christians who came today. They just said one thing. They said one thing that was full of meaning, which was, one day we will meet again in the place of ultimate truth, unquote. Just this one statement was enough. Those were the words of a wise person. No matter what kind of Dhamma we learn, if we don't realize the ultimate truth, the Paramatta Dhamma, in our hearts, we won't reach satisfaction. For example, Sumedho might teach me. I have to take that knowledge and try to put it into practice. When Sumedho is teaching me, I understand, but it isn't a real or deep understanding because I haven't yet practiced. When I do actually practice and realize the fruit of practicing, then I will get the point and know the real meaning of it. Then I can say, I know Sumedho. I will see Sumedho in that place. That place is Sumedho, because he teaches that. That is Sumedho. When I teach about the Buddha, it's like that also. I say the Buddha is that place. The Buddha is not in the teachings. When people hear this, they will be startled. Huh? Didn't the Buddha teach those things? Yes, he did. But this is talking about ultimate truth. People don't understand it yet. What I gave those people to think about was, this apple is something that you can see with your eyes. The flavor of the apple isn't something that you can know by looking at it. But you do see the apple. I felt that was as much as they were able to listen to. You can't see the flavor, but it's there. When will you know it? When you pick up the apple and eat it. The Dhamma that we teach is like the apple. People hear it, but they don't really know the flavor of the apple. When they practice, then it can be known. The flavor of the apple can't be known by the eyes, and the truth of the Dhamma can't be known by the ears. There is knowledge, true, but it doesn't reach the actuality. One has to put it into practice. Then wisdom arises and one recognizes the ultimate truth directly. One sees the Buddha there. That is the profound Dhamma. So I compared it to an apple in this way for them. I offered it to that group of Christians to hear and think about. That kind of talk was a little salty, which is in Thai that means direct rather than being inappropriate, as it would in English. That kind of talk was a little salty, direct. Salty is good. Sweet is good. Sour is good. Many different ways of teaching are good. Well, if you've got something to say, any of you, please feel free to say it. Soon we won't have a chance to discuss things. Tomatoes probably run out of things to say. That didn't happen. So, and then Ajahn Sumedho says, I'm fed up explaining things to people. To which Lumpo Cha responds, don't do that. You can't be fed up. But to which Ajahn Sumedho replies, yes, I'll cut that off. And then Ajahn Cha responds, the head teacher can't do that. There are a lot of people trying to reach Nibbana, so they're depending on you. Sometimes teaching comes easily. Sometimes you don't know what to say. You're at a loss for words. Nothing comes out. Or is it that you just don't want to talk? It's good training for you. Ajahn Sumedho responds, people around here are pretty good. They aren't violent and mean-spirited or troublesome. The Christian priests don't dislike us. The kinds of questions people ask are about things like God. They want to know what God is, what Nibbana is. Some people believe that Buddhism teaches nihilism and wants to destroy the world. To which Lumpo Cha responds, it means their understanding is not complete or mature. They're afraid everything will be finished, that the world will come to an end. They conceive of Dhamma as something empty and nihilistic, so they're disheartened. Their way only leads to tears. Have you seen what it's like when people are afraid of emptiness? Householders try to gather possessions and watch over them like rats. Does this protect them from the emptiness of existence? They still end up on the funeral pyre. Everything is lost to them. But while they're alive, they're trying to hold on to things. Every day, afraid they'll be lost, trying to avoid emptiness. Do they suffer this way? Of course, they really do suffer. It's not understanding the real insubstantiality and emptiness of things. Not understanding this, people are not happy. Because people don't look at themselves, they don't really know what's going on in life. How do you stop this delusion? People believe, this is me, this is mine. If you tell them about not self, nothing is me or mine, they're ready to argue the point till the day they die. Even the Buddha, after he attained knowledge, felt weary when he considered this. When he was first enlightened, he thought that it would be extremely troublesome to explain the way to others. But then he realized that such an attitude was not correct. If we don't teach such people, who will we teach? This is my question, which I used to ask myself at those times when I got fed up and I didn't want to teach anymore. Who should we teach if we don't teach the deluded? There's really nowhere else to go. When we get fed up and want to run away from disciples and live alone, we are deluded. Then one of the bhikkhus, probably Ajahn Anando, said, we could be pacheka Buddhas, like solitary Buddhas. And Lumpo Cha responds, that's good, but it's not really correct. Being a pacheka Buddha, because you simply want to run away from things. Then Lumpo Sumedho says, just living naturally in a simple environment, then we could naturally be Pacheka Buddhas. But these days, it's not possible. The environment we live in doesn't allow that to happen. We have to live as monks. Ajahn Chah responds, sometimes you have to live in a situation like you have here first, with some disturbance. To explain it in a simple way, sometimes you'll be an omniscient Buddha, sometimes you'll be a Pacheka. It depends on conditions. Talking about these kind of beings is talking about the mind. It's not that one is born a Pacheka. This is what is called explanation by personification of states of mind. Pugala Dittana. Being a Pacheka, one abides indifferently and doesn't teach. Not much benefit comes from that. But when someone is able to teach others, then they are manifesting as an omniscient Buddha. But these are only metaphors. Don't be anything. Don't be anything at all. Being a Buddha is a burden. Being a Pacheka is a burden. Just don't desire to be. I am the monk Sumedho. I am the monk Anando. That way is suffering. Believing that you really exist, Sumedho, is merely a convention. Do you understand? Believing you really exist brings suffering. If there is Sumedho, then when someone criticizes you, Sumedho gets angry. Anando gets angry. That's what happens if you hold things as real. Anando and Sumedho get involved and are ready to fight. If there's no Anando or no Sumedho, then there's no one there. No one to answer the telephone. Ring, ring. Nobody picks it up. You don't become anything. No one is being anything, and there is no suffering. If we believe ourselves to be something or someone, then every time the phone rings, we pick it up and get involved. How can we free ourselves of this? We have to look at it clearly and develop wisdom, so that there is no Anando or no Sumedho to pick up the phone. If you are Anando or Sumedho, and you answer the telephone, you'll get yourself involved in suffering. So, don't be Sumedho. Don't be Anando. Just recognize that these names are on the level of convention. If somebody calls you, good. Don't be that. Don't think, I'm good. If somebody calls you bad, don't think, I'm bad. Don't try to be anything. Know what is taking place. But then, don't attach to the knowledge either. People can't do this. They don't understand what it's all about. When they hear about this, they are confused and they don't know what to do. I've given the analogy before about upstairs and downstairs. When you go from upstairs, you're downstairs. You see the downstairs. When you go upstairs again, you see the upstairs. The space in between, you don't see, the middle. It means Nibbana is not seen. We see the forms of physical objects, but we don't see the grasping. The grasping at upstairs and downstairs. Becoming and birth, continual becoming. The place without becoming is empty. When we try to teach people about the place that is empty, they just say, there's nothing there. They don't understand. It's difficult. Real practice is required for this to be understood. I'll leave it there. So that was the last talk in this book called Everything is Teaching Us, called Even One Word is Enough, if you're interested.